Hey, do you see? Half the school has COVID.
So I guess we're just sending them to school?
That's what it says.
So I guess that's what we're doing. Da,
da, da, we don't talk about COVID. No, no, no. We don't talk about COVID. But we were rolling out tonight.
This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is the Holderness Family, which makes funny song parodies on YouTube. I've had that song on my mind a lot lately, as COVID is still out there. I know quite a few people who've gotten sick recently, but no one seems to be talking about it in real life, and especially not in the media. And then I remembered, wait, I'm in the media. So here we go. After the winter surge and the Omicron wave abated, many of us were hoping the years of hypervigilance and fear were in the rearview mirror. Yet, new variants emerged, infections are rising again, and on a serious note, people are still dying from COVID. More than 1 million of our fellow Americans so far. The perception of COVID-19 and the reaction to the threats it poses have undeniably changed since March of 2020. Today, we are joined by two experts to talk about these changes, the current state of the pandemic, and what the future holds. With us is Lori Ann Post, a professor and director of the Bueller Center for Health Policy and Economics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Professor Post, welcome to the 21st show. And also, Professor Post, are you there with us? Might be muted this Zoom era. All right. And we're also with Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, a professor and chief of infectious diseases at Southern Illinois University's School of Medicine in Springfield. She also serves as medical advisor to the Sangamon County Department of Public Health. Dr. Sundaresan, welcome back to you.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And listeners, 800-222-9455. We want to know, how are you thinking about COVID at this stage of the pandemic? Have you had it recently in the past year? Have you managed to avoid it so far? Are you still masking and taking precautions? What questions do you have for our guests? You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. So, Professor Post, I'm going to begin with you. How do we define, you know, a COVID-19 outbreak at this point in the pandemic, or another wave, possibly?
How do we define it? Well, we would define it, this, you know, surge of cases as an outbreak. It's still an epidemic in the United States. It's still a pandemic globally.
I mean, as of last week, Illinois was one of six states leading outbreaks. There were eight counties as of a week ago, and I checked this morning the CDC. I don't think has updated its website yet for today. But where is Illinois? How does Illinois fit into that national picture?
So, out of 50 states right now, Illinois ranks 11th in terms of the number of cases per day per 100,000 population. They're at 41 cases per day per 100,000. However, I will say Illinois is looking up in the coming week. We should see a significant contraction in the pandemic. However, that is not experienced in a lot of other states, and there are several states that will have exponential growth. So it's not that the pandemic comes and hits the whole US or Illinois all at one time. It moves around all the time. It's very dynamic.
Why are you anticipating a contraction in Illinois?
Oh, because I can measure it. So basically, I look at the number of cases today, how fast those cases are accelerating, and then this week compared to last week, and then I also measure exponential growth. And so I can see that the exponential growth is going to contract over the next week for Illinois specifically. But there are other places where it's going to increase dramatically. So for example, places like Hawaii, Delaware, New Jersey, they'll be expanding pretty big.
Dr. Sundaresan, I'm wondering what you're seeing in Sangamon County in the Springfield area. How are you advising local health officials to respond to this current phase of the pandemic?
So we're seeing pretty much what is seen statewide. Our community transmission has definitely increased quite a bit. We are seeing some increase in the hospitalization as well. The curve, however, is not as steep, which is encouraging, but you know, community transmission has risen quite a lot. And, you know, we can look at this as a hidden wave because we are really not capturing a lot of the home tests that are not being counted in the numbers that we have recorded. So the magnitude of the community transmission is definitely more than what we are seeing in the reports.
So that's interesting, yeah, because a lot of people are testing at home, so it's maybe not getting reported. Should people, let me ask you that, should people, if they do take one of these home tests, should they call the health department and try and report that information, or is there even a way to do that?
There is, but we are not contact tracing here in Sangamon County. They do call for advice. A lot of people call the county when they test positive for next steps. What do I do? Do I need to go see a doctor? Can I manage this at home? So there are lots of questions still coming from people when they test positive. But it doesn't really get recorded formally into the tracking system. People who are seeking help by going to an urgent care or ER, those are the numbers that actually get reported.
Interesting. So, Professor Pose, let me ask you about that, because we have this compounding then. So there's people taking tests at home. That's not getting counted in the numbers. The CDC, right, some months ago changed the kind of color coding so that, mm-hmm, you know, what used to be considered flashing red high transmission is now maybe just medium. Do we have a sense of how much disease burden there is in the community at this time?
In the community in Illinois?
Well, in Illinois in general. Yeah. I mean, is there a lot more cases than going to the, you know, the New York Times website tracker will tell us?
Oh, definitely. So basically, surveillance at best is always just a proxy for what's going on out there. So cases like, so people go in and do a PCR test, that one gets picked up by healthcare systems, the positivity rate and how many people were tested and how many people tested positive. So we do pick that up. And so many people who do home tests then will follow up with a PCR test and it gets picked up that way. But again, it's very, always an undercount. There are a lot of asymptomatic people or people who just don't report it and weather it out at home.
All right, I'm going to go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Cynthia in Springfield is on line 4. Cynthia, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this topic up. My husband has a blood cancer, and he did not make any antibodies to full vaccines, so we still live like it's 2020. We don't go out to eat. We don't see our friends. We go to work, and we come home.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that. Is it frustrating to you seeing that most of the other people in the community seem to have, like, you know, quote unquote, moved on from the pandemic?
It is. It is frustrating and it's isolating. And to the point earlier about case counts and positivity rates, you know, what we did in 2020 and even 2021 when we had positivity rates where they are now is very different from what we are currently doing. And so that leaves a very significant portion of the population unable to participate in society.
Yeah, and we've had those conversations about people who have immune compromise problems. So, Cynthia, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
I appreciate you sharing your perspective with us. Professor Post, can you talk about that? It seems like there is this psychological shift if people don't have a vulnerable member of their household.
Right.
In the way they respond to this, what explains that diminishing sense of fear?
Well, I think that at the public messaging, even from our leaders, that it's not just a cold. That's really important, and that people are at significant risk who have immune compromised situations, such as having cancer or other types of diseases as well. And those people literally are locked in because nobody's masking. And so, unfortunately, if you wear a mask, it only prevents you from catching about 5% of the cases, but masking, the benefit of masking is that it prevents other people from spreading the disease to you. So this marginalizes and isolates a significant portion of our population. And it's not a cold and they can't just get over it. And so it's too bad that we kind of let the genie out of the bottle, and I don't think we can put it back in because people have moved on and decided, well, we're just going to live with it. And I've heard it's endemic. It's not endemic. It's still a complete outbreak. It's still an epidemic. It's in the United States. It's still a pandemic globally, and we shouldn't treat it as a cold. And Omicron, the other thing is Omicron is treated as, well, it's just like a cold. It's not so bad like the other ones. But what happens is for every time the disease is transmitted to another person, that transmission comes with mutations. And so every time there's a transmission, we increase the likelihood of producing a new variant of concern that's even worse than Omicron, more transmissible. And the next one could also be much more lethal and result in adverse outcomes like death, hospitalizations, and compromised health.
And Dr. Sundaresan, on that point, there is that notion out there, you hear this a lot in the media, that Omicron is somehow milder. My understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that it's not actually inherently milder. It's because a lot of people have been vaccinated or maybe have prior infection that it's milder for them. But there's nothing that's really changed about the disease to make it less severe for somebody who's never encountered it before. Is that right?
With Omicron, we do see some features which are in fact a little bit more concerning. If you look on the mutation maps, the evolution of this virus is much accelerated as compared to what we have seen with the previous variants, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. So the mutations are occurring so rapidly. We already have BA4, BA5, BA1, and now, the most prominent strain that we are encountering with is the BA2 12.1. So the transmissibility of this is still really very high. It may cause milder disease, but like you rightly said, you're seeing a lot of breakthrough infections because this virus does seem to have an immune escape or immune evasion property too. So if they've had an Omicron BA1 variant, it doesn't necessarily confer protection to the other variants as well. So in reality, even if we think that the symptomatology of Omicron is different and may appear to be less severe, the way the virus is, there are some concerning things about Omicron.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-222-9455. We are speaking with Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, Chief of Infectious Diseases at the SIU School of Medicine in Springfield, and Professor Lorianne Post from the Buehler Center for Health Policy and Economics at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. 800-222-9455. And Emily is on line one. Emily, thank you for calling in.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I live in Champaign, and I have two kids. One's 18 and one is 10. And yesterday, we just got the booster for the 10-year-old, so yay. And he has some chronic conditions that would put him at additional risk, and they involve respiratory issues. So we were really sweating this, and it's very hard to tell a 10-year-old, keep your mask on, when he sees adults and other children running around or indoors without a mask. So I was really sweating this until he could qualify for a booster. And he still is asked repeatedly by me when we go somewhere to wear his mask indoors. And if we're outdoors and there is a large crowd of people, we either move to another area or, I ask him to put his mask on. Thankfully, not too many people in Champaign are openly rude. They don't give me really weird looks. But it really surprises me when we go indoors to simple places like supermarkets and the pharmacy, how many people are walking around without their masks on indoors. Mm-hmm. It's a simple ask to wear a mask, especially when you're indoors and you're doing a quick errand. When we come out, we take our mask off. And then when we go back in, we put our mask on. I think it's just really the right thing to do in terms of community safety. And it just surprises me. I just don't think it's such a big ask for people to put their masks on when they go indoors or they're in a more crowded area. You're just being a little careful, and it's for the safety of our community.
Emily, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. Appreciate the call. Professor Post, I heard you saying, in there. Did you want to respond to anything she said?
Yeah. So number one, Omicron, by the way, is just as lethal as Delta is for children 10 and under. And so it's very alarming. And so the belief behind it being so less severe is because it's upper respiratory as opposed to lower respiratory. However, upper respiratory are more likely to adversely affect smaller children. Unfortunately for Emily, her son, is only protected, 5% of the cases. And and how everybody thinks about, well, it's my right. I don't have to wear a mask. And it's like, well, that is your right, but do you have a right to infect and harm other people? Which I think not. But so that's why I don't understand loosening up the policies so quickly when we have a big outbreak of Omicron or a more severe version of Omicron that's more transmissible.
But that is the message from the government, from public health authorities, from
Definitely.
The education authorities. Yeah.
I don't agree with the message. And I see it even at the national level or the advisory for our president as well, is that, well, it's endemic. We're going to have to learn to live with it. And it's not endemic at this point, and we don't have to learn to live with it. And a lot of people are suffering. More people are in hospitals and dying from Omicron than any other variant of concern because it's so transmissible. And the more it transmits around the world, the more it proliferates, it's going to result in more variants of concern, and they could very well be more lethal.
Dr. Sundaresan, I understand Memorial Hospital in Springfield recently reinstituted the mask requirement for staff. Is that accurate?
Yeah. With healthcare, that's one sector where masking is absolutely necessary. It doesn't matter what's going on outside, but healthcare people are required to wear masks while at work. But when not in directly patient care facing areas, people in business offices, etc., had the choice not to wear a mask at their workplace. And especially when they're at their desk by themselves. So they had that choice when they're not directly in patient care facing areas. So that, in fact, I think has been reversed. So they are now recommending that everybody wear a mask while in the buildings. So that is helpful. And then also looking at patients who are coming in to see if they're asymptomatic and carrying the virus and getting tested positive for the virus. So, people that are taking care of them don't get sick. The other people around them, if they're sharing rooms, don't get sick. So these are some of the things that have changed and have tightened up.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation when we come back. 800-222-9455. We're going to have some practical tips, too, for what happens if you do get COVID, what precautions you should still be taking. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about COVID-19 and the pandemic that is still with us. Cases have gone up. A number of Illinois counties, 8 as of a week ago. The numbers haven't been updated for this week yet. 8 Illinois counties were considered high transmission areas by the CDC, which that means the CDC recommends people avoid crowded indoor spaces. People wear masks when indoors in those 8 counties. Much of the rest of the state is at a significant part of the state, at least, is at medium transmission. We're talking about this with Lorianne Post, who's a professor and director of the Buehler Center for Health Policy and Economics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, professor and chief of infectious diseases at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in Springfield. She's also a medical advisor to the health department in Sangamon County. 800-222-9455. If you have a question or you want to join our conversation, we want to know, how are you handling COVID? Are you thinking about it? Or are you happy to be one of the people who's not thinking about it anymore, as much at least? 800-222-9455 is the number. So Dr. Sundaresan, a lot of people, vaccinated included, are getting sick. And we've learned that vaccines are meant to prevent severe disease. These vaccines are not really meant, or at least after the initial shot, they don't necessarily prevent someone from being infected. One of the things that people are getting is this drug called Paxlovid. Can you talk a little bit about that? How does it work? How patients can get it?
Yeah. We have a very effective medication which can prevent about 90% reduction in a hospitalization for people who get COVID. So it's much more effective than the medications we have for flu. It's now readily available. Physicians who are providers who are taking care of patients with COVID as an outpatient, once they're getting diagnosed, they are able to order these through pharmacies where they're available. There are websites on IDPH's support where they will tell you where exactly these the medication is available, which pharmacy carries it. We don't have this in Springfield, but there is also a test to treat program where pharmacies, right after a diagnosis of COVID, if it's occurring there at the same place, can also provide medication through the pharmacists. So this is an effective medication. It comes in a bubble pack of 5 days is all that you need to take this medication for. And it's fairly effective in keeping people out of the hospital.
What about the eligibility? I understand it's meant for, you know, people who have, you know, diabetes or heart condition or obesity or some, one of these risk factors, maybe they're older. But I mean, is this something that everyone should try to get their hands on if they have a positive test?
Well, if they have risk factors, then yes, they become eligible in terms of obesity. If they're older than 65 years, they become eligible, having any of the immunocompromising conditions. The list is fairly inclusive for eligibility. So once someone gets diagnosed with COVID, it's definitely something that you should talk to your provider about to see if you're eligible and then get the medication if you can.
And is this something as well where I know a lot of people are making summer travel plans? Maybe they're going to be traveling to sort of a remote part of the country or another country where maybe they might not be able to get it. Is it something people can get sort of a pre-prescription for, or is that not something that's possible?
Not something as of yet, but that would be a good idea.
Interesting. All right. Professor Post, I want to ask you about something that came up earlier in our conversation about contact tracing. It was mentioned that that's not being done in Sangamon County. The statewide, they are really ceasing operations of contact tracing. It's going to be there will be text messages sent instead. Can you talk about, was that system really working well? Was it being used? That's something we heard a lot about in the early days of the pandemic, contact tracing. Honestly, when I saw the press release from the state that they were shutting it down, I had no idea the state was even still trying to do that.
Yeah, no, it's a program that never really went well in America. Contact tracing was done very well in Asia, for example. So in countries that had COVID zero policies like China, like Vietnam, other places around East Asia, they did a very good job of identifying who had the disease and tracking it back and who they came in contact. New Zealand also was another great, had great public health control.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-222-9455. Is it Shay in Decatur?
Yes.
Thank you for calling in. Go ahead, please.
I'm just curious as far as other vaccine options. I know that Novavax is being used in several other countries, and it seems like the United States is just focusing solely on the other two vaccines. I know Johnson & Johnson, you could say, is a third, but really the success of it has been well with that, whereas Pfizer and Moderna are the two they focus on, when I think that at this rate, with all of the different variants that are coming out, we should be focusing on other options, especially ones that seem to have a lower risk involved after post-vaccination, essentially.
And I understand you have a reason that you're reluctant to take the mRNA vaccines.
Correct, yes. I know that there's lots of heart-related issues, especially with children. I have a 9.5-year-old, so that's a concern of mine, and I've had vascular health issues in the past and family history of that, so that's been my concern. I'm not necessarily an anti-vaxxer, never been. I have every other vaccine, whereas Novavax is more along the lines of something that, as that of the flu vaccine. So I think that the vaccine hesitancy would go away if they would authorize the Novavax and other vaccines that are made in that way, essentially.
All right, Shay, thank you for calling in. Let me get Dr. Sundaresan. Do you have a perspective on what she had to say there?
Well, I think FDA looks at the data very, very carefully, and they do that periodically. It would be nice to have more choices. People who come here for employment purposes or are visiting have received these vaccines from outside and want to get a booster here, where we're still actually honoring those. WHO recognizes a set of vaccines which are very effective. When people have gotten these vaccines outside of the U.S. and coming in, these are definitely something that are that is recognized. FDA and ACIP with CDC looks very carefully at the data to see what would be most effective, and hopefully we will have an expansion in that choice that we will have for people in vaccination.
But doctor, let me ask you though. I mean, so she was concerned about heart possible side effects with the vaccine. There are also, I mean, it's not a risk-free decision to not get vaccinated either. Can you put those risks in context?
I can put that in a context.
Oh. I'm sorry?
I said I would be happy to put that in a
sure,
context.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
So anyway, so I don't agree at all. There are so many great studies that have been done recently on mRNA vaccines, and they are shown to be the ones that are most efficacious at reducing adverse outcomes. So if you have mRNA vaccines, you get a reduction of 70% in deaths and hospitalizations. And we know that we already have partial immunity escape. And that means that even if you've had mRNA vaccines and if you've had the boost, you can still catch Omicron. And we see that people are still catching it. However, compared to other vaccines, it's not holding up. The protection is just not holding up. And so I think we know that in countries that don't have mRNA vaccines because they didn't have the way to distribute it or keep it chilled at the temperature that it needed to go, those countries have much higher death rates than countries with mRNA vaccines. So for example, number one in the world right now is Taiwan. They have 346 cases per day per 100,000 population. They rank number one in exponential growth. However, they rank 102 rank in deaths. In the death rate. If you catch COVID, you're not likely going to die if you've had mRNA vaccines in the boosters.
800-222-9455. We're speaking with Professor Lorianne Post of Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's director of the Center for Health Policy and Economics there, and also Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, infectious disease doctor at the SIU School of Medicine in Springfield, 800-222-9455. Dr. Sundaresan, I also wanted to ask about boosters for COVID. We heard a caller earlier say she was excited to get the booster for her 10-year-old. I should say I've got two young children myself. We've got them, their appointments to get their third shots coming up in the coming weeks. But some people are on a fourth booster shot now, or I should say a fourth shot, a second booster. Gets a little confusing here. What about people younger than 50 seeking that booster shot? I know several who have done that. Is that a good idea?
Are you specifically referring to the fourth?
Yes, the fourth shot, right? I know it's so confusing. So yes, it's a given that you should get definitely the first two shots and the first booster, which I guess the CDC now says is quote unquote up to date with your vaccines is how they're phrasing it. But now people are getting this second booster, this fourth shot overall. But that's only for people, as I understand it, age 50 and older, or maybe with certain immune situations, but is it a good idea to get that? Should people younger than that? I know several who have done this. They've kind of just walked into pharmacies and said, "Hey, can I get another shot?" And you know, they did. Is that a good idea? Is that something? Or what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, just to clarify, the definition of up to date with vaccination actually differs with age and immunocompromising conditions or any other comorbidities that people have. So CDC has specific recommendations for who should be getting the fourth booster, which is people over the age of 50, especially if they have any comorbidities. If they're less than age 50, they are then eligible. So if there are these comorbidities, specifically the immunocompromising conditions, yes, I think there is definitely some value. But if they're 48, they're fairly healthy, athletic, do they need the vaccine, the fourth dose? Probably not. If they're 48, 49, they're diabetic, they've got hypertension, they have a history of cancer, yes, definitely. In those situations, yes. With the vaccination, we have antibody response, and then we also have a cellular response. So in people who are healthy, less than 50, The cellular response is reasonably good. So at least for now, the fourth booster for people that are over age 50 or if they have other health conditions, that is when it's really effective and useful. In the fall, when we will have actually maybe a multivariant vaccine, that should be something that we should all be looking to take.
Mm-hmm. Look forward to that. Professor Post, just a few minutes remaining. I want to talk about this idea of, and you touched on this earlier, but in endemic or endemicity, if I'm saying that right. You know, it seems like a lot of society is treating COVID the way it does the flu. If you get it, people think you'll probably be fine, so I'm going to live my life. On the other hand, the CDC doesn't make people isolate when they contract the flu or, you know, wear a tight-fitting mask when they're opposed to it, as they recommend for COVID. Flu vaccines are nowhere near as good as the COVID vaccines. When do you think we might treat COVID like the flu, or should we?
I don't know that we ever should. We don't have to live with disease if we don't want to. We can end it. And so, I mean, endemic versus versus pandemic, or which is, you know, globally happening in multiple countries. So right now, one third of the world is that's reporting data that we know of is in a full outbreak, right? And in America, as I said before, we have 47 out of 50 states that are in an outbreak. So we're not even close to endemic. Endemic is when you have the disease, you live with it constantly. It's simmering away someplace, but you get little outbreaks that are localized, you know, at a smaller geography. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just little small surges there too. But right now we're talking the whole place is full of an outbreak, and we have exponential growth going on. And I think exponential growth really defines what an epidemic is and a pandemic, which means basically exponential growth at a large geographical region. So we're not there yet. It's a long time. And so because we're letting this thing go on unabated, by you know, dropping our public health prevention policies, it's very well likely that we're going to develop new variants of concern. And again, we're going to have to deal with outbreak after outbreak or surges from new variants.
We're going to have to leave this conversation there. We will return to it again, I'm sure. Professor Lorianne Post, Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I do want to say today is a sad day for us at the show. We're saying farewell to one of our colleagues. This is producer Anna Casey's last episode of the 21st. She's moving to Washington, D.C. to join the staff of the national NPR talk show 1A. She'll be part of a project called Remaking America. Anna, congratulations. We will miss you. Your contributions have been invaluable in the past few years. Best of luck in D.C. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.